Hi, good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of the Center for Universal Education at the Brookings Institution, I'm very pleased to welcome you all here. I'm Allison Anderson. I'm a fellow at the Center for Universal Education. And over the next hour and a half, we're going to focus on the next steps for education in Haiti as it transitions from relief to development. I think, as everyone in this room is well aware, the earthquake on the 12th of January devastated what was already one of the world's poorest countries. More than 220,000 people were killed, 1.3 million people were left homeless, and more than 1,300 education facilities collapsed, rendering as many as 90% of them in the most affected areas unusable. And this was on top of what was already considered to be an education crisis in Haiti. More than 55% of school-aged children were not in school, and about 80% of classrooms were run by private entities where there was very little oversight or quality control from the Ministry of Education. And quality varied immensely in the education that was being offered. We're extremely fortunate today to have three experts who are going to look back at what worked, examine the current education reform efforts, analyze lessons from the recovery that can be put towards the development process, and discuss the future of education in Haiti. We have, I guess, starting with Peter at the end, Peter Holland, who's an education specialist and the Haiti team leader at the World Bank. We have Lisa Dowdry, the Regional Education and Emergency Specialist at UNICEF for Eastern and Southern Africa. And Marcelo Sabrol, the Education Division at the Inter-American Development Bank. And you all have bios on these three very distinguished speakers, so you can see information on their very extensive work experience and accomplishments. I'm not going to take the time here to go over that verbally. Instead, what we'd like to do for the next 30 minutes is to hear from them. And I have a pointed question for each of them. And then after that, we'll open up for questions and discussion to really move forward this topic. Before we get started, I would like to ask that if you haven't done so already, please silence your cell phones. Just give you a second to do that. So we're going to start with Lisa, who, as I introduced her, she's currently been working with UNICEF in Eastern and Southern Africa. But for several months this summer, she worked in Haiti with the IASC Education Cluster in the earthquake response. For those of you who aren't familiar with the cluster, it is the mechanism for humanitarian coordination in emergency and crisis contexts. And just to open up, Lisa, given your experience working with the cluster and looking back at the response effort and now the transition into recovery and eventually development, how did coordination work? What worked well? What didn't?
So the education cluster was established in the first days of the earthquake response under the co-leadership of UNICEF and Save the Children, as is the global agreement for the IASC education cluster. And the coordination mechanism brought together all of the different actors who were working on the education response in Haiti, UN agencies, NGOs, international and national, religious groups, academic and private institutions, with the objective of ensuring that all of the response efforts were effectively coordinated to ensure that needs were met, but also to ensure that the Ministry of Education, with the ultimate responsibility for the education sector, was well supported. So in the initial stages, there were literally dozens of different organizations and individuals who were part of the cluster. That has grown enormously over the six, eight, 9 months since. Now the cluster has over 300 different members. 200 different organizations, so really a huge variety of actors working in the sector. And the role of the cluster at the initial stages for the acute response phase was to ensure that information was properly gathered on the extent of the impact of the earthquake. Needs assessments were conducted in a coordinated way, making sure that all affected areas, not just in Port-au-Prince, but also outside in Laogan and Jacmel and other parts of the affected zone, were adequately looked at and gaps were identified. We wanted to make sure that there was no duplication of efforts between the various partners working in the affected areas. And working with the Ministry of Education to really get a good picture of the impact of the earthquake, which was in or around 5,000 schools affected, and that's really an enormous number and really took a lot of efforts from the very broad composition of the cluster partners to make sure that the needs of those learners and teachers and schools were met. So in the initial stages, coordination focused, as I said, on assessment, but also fundraising. The appeal was launched in January, February, which looked at the initial estimate of needs and damage, and really focused education cluster partners on the initial response needs around establishment of temporary learning spaces, which were safe environments for learners to return to, teacher training on psychosocial support so the teachers could identify and conduct activities within the classroom for children affected and refer them to specialist services where needed. And also on risk reduction, because, of course, the children were very scared about the impact of the earthquake, and the teachers needed to be able to teach them about what had happened and what to do if it happened again. The cluster partners also focused very much on supporting the Ministry of Education to develop a condensed curriculum, which was then rolled out across the affected zones. So everything really was culminating in efforts to support reopening of schools in April. And that was the initial phase, let's say, of the acute response of the cluster. Then we moved onwards, looking at the longer-term recovery. Really, the composition of the cluster had to change to ensure that those needs were being identified and addressed, looking at making sure that at sub-national level, the cluster was really reaching all of the affected areas. So we had sub-national clusters in a number of different towns, but we also then established commune clusters in Port-au-Prince itself, which were co-led or co-chaired by the cluster and the school inspectors for those communes. And that really ensured that the ministry was very much engaged at the local levels. Obviously, the inspectors knew the schools very well, so we were able to work with them to do more in-depth assessments beyond school infrastructure, but looking at needs in terms of materials, in terms of water, sanitation, etc. So at this stage then, we also looked at a revision of the appeal, which was also an opportunity to take stock of where we were in the response and what the longer-term needs would be. A lot on looking at, obviously, school reconstruction, working with the ministry on norms and standards for infrastructure reconstruction, building back better, making sure that schools were disaster resistant, looking at teacher training on the actual condensed curriculum so that teachers were able to go out and teach an accelerated curriculum, which often had, you know, double the number of children in a class than had been there before. And all of the partners would meet regularly. We had cut down the frequency of education cluster meetings to ensure that you know, people weren't just sitting in meetings all the time, but that information was getting out and was being shared appropriately, and that partners were reporting back, so we in the cluster were able to act as a liaison, really, between all of the partners and the ministry, and making sure that they knew what was happening, where we had different tools and mechanisms for that. Who does what where? Tools, very simply, just making sure that we knew what actual activities were being conducted and making sure that they were meeting the needs as they emerged as we moved along. It was also very important at that stage to ensure that the cluster, which had been really focused on the initial response, was aligning with the existing sector coordination mechanism. And that in Haiti is the GSE, Groupe Sectoriel d'Education, which really was composed, is composed of the key bilateral partners. And within that group, they were looking at the longer-term reconstruction strategy and reorganization plans for the sector. Obviously, it was very important for the cluster with such a broad membership of partners who were working on immediate needs and medium-term needs to also align well with those structures. So our subgroups within the cluster, looking at school reconstruction, for example, teacher training, early learning, they were as closely as possible aligned to the broader sector coordination mechanisms. And that is definitely something we've learned. It's very important to initiate those linkages early on and to really focus on ensuring that those, there's obviously complementarities between both mechanisms, but also overlap. So we had to make sure that we were aligning well without duplicating our efforts. And then, obviously, because we were coming into cyclone season, the cluster was very focused on preparedness and broader disaster risk reduction. So we worked closely with the Ministry of Education at departmental and local level, the school inspectors, and the disaster management body within the government to conduct and roll out training on risk reduction, on preparedness, on contingency planning, and really getting ready for what was predicted to be a very severe cyclone season. Obviously, with people living in camps and in makeshift schools, we wanted to make sure that they were protected. So that was a focus through the recovery phase of the cluster as well.
Great, thank you. Thank you, and I think you know what you said is really true. The need to align with the other sort of sector coordination groups, and that's something we've seen over and over again as a problem. So it's great to hear that that was something that was really focused on for better coordination. And in addition to, as you said, some of the information management, the who does what where, making sure there aren't those gaps,
yeah.
Not just gaps, but there aren't duplication of efforts. Thank you. I'm going to turn now to Peter Holland. And from your experience working within the World Bank on Haiti and working in Haiti over the last several years, how would you characterize the ongoing reform efforts right now? You know, what are some of the major barriers and what are some opportunities that we have in front of us?
Thanks, Allison. Thanks for the introduction and for the question. It's a good one. I think reform is at the forefront of our minds as we see how we can move forward in rebuilding Haiti's education sector. What I'd like to do is compare this latest reform that's kind of still ongoing with the most previous wave. As you may know, Haiti's been undergoing sort of a continuous reform since 1982. There's various attempts, and none of them have been terribly successful. So the latest reform is what we refer to as the Education for All strategy. It's part of the Education for All fast-track initiative process, and it was endorsed at the global level by the donors in 2008. And that strategy focused largely on five things. And, of course, the overall goal that we're talking about is universal free education, free primary education. So the five things, and the strategy didn't necessarily, I mean, I say focus, it didn't really have much of a focus. It had a laundry list of very good things, as we've become accustomed to in Haiti. But the five of the main things were, one, to build a system of what they call école de proximité. So these are kind of small, incomplete, rural schools, to reduce the time it takes children to get to school, basically. So maybe two classrooms type thing. Second, build more public schools. Of course, the country only has about 10% of the institutions are public in the education sector. Third, to provide public financing to private schools, so to those 90% of education providers, in order to reduce school fees for families. Fourth, to reform the teacher training system from a 3-year program to a 1-year program to get more teachers on the market sooner. And then five, to design an accelerated program for older out-of-school youth. The idea being that these 12 and 15-year-olds that have never been to school, let's see if we can get them into school and out of school without them being 25 when they graduate. And then this plan had been financed or is being financed by CEDA in part, by the Caribbean Development Bank in part, by the World Bank in part, most recently by the Education for All Fast Track Initiatives Catalytic Fund that provided a $22 million grant. And soon by the IDB as well, that are coming in and co-financing this tuition waiver program, this public financing of private schools to reduce tuition fees. And overall, it's about $100 million since 2007, and there's now a trust fund in place housed at the World Bank to channel more resources to finance this education strategy and other education strategies in a way that reduces the costs for the government and for the donors to get more funds into the sector. The new reform takes on these five areas that I've just mentioned, and the new reform sort of started... So the new reform does two things differently. First, it undertook a 2-year consultation process led by this presidential commission, led by Jackie Remarque, who's one of the foremost authorities in Haiti on education. Mm-hmm. And this was a significant process. This wasn't just about talking to the local education cronies in Port-au-Prince. This was actually going out to the rural areas and really getting a sense of the pulse out there and building what they call a national pact, including with the diaspora, and financed and coordinated by the IDB to get this kind of agreement together. This is a significant thing, and that's not something that the previous reform did. A second major difference is that this new reform, which was recently presented to the commission, the Reconstruction Commission in Haiti, and is now ready to operationalize. So in addition to taking on those five things at the primary and kind of preschool level, it maps out priorities or activities for secondary education, tertiary education, vocational training, and even ECD more kind of comprehensively. That is, it's very ambitious. It's even more ambitious than the previous ambitious plan. Those are the two areas where it's different. Otherwise, it's very similar, both in terms of the substance, as I just mentioned, similar in terms of the weaknesses. Both plans don't make any of the difficult decisions. They're going to tackle access. They're going to tackle quality. The targets are, you know, as Alberto Begué likes to highlight, the targets are 100% across the board. Everything is 100% this and 100% that, and we're going to do all of these things in the next 3 years or 5 years. Second, that there's no real prioritization. It doesn't say this is the sequencing, these are the activities that need to happen first, and then we can do the other activities, and these are really the sine qua non. Third, neither plan really assigns responsibility. So who is responsible for achieving these targets? I could go on, but I think you guys get the gist. And I don't think it's really useful. I mean, I don't think that it's useful for donors to embark in kind of this academic back and forth with local authorities and amongst ourselves to say, oh, this target should be this and what, you know. These plans come and go, and there's good capacity in Haiti for developing these plans. The challenge is implementing them. And so we really just need to see how we can move forward and start implementing the critical parts of these plans, which... there's kind of agreement on. So I'm going to switch to the second part of the question, which is the opportunities and barriers, and I'll try to wrap it up quickly. But there's, as I see it, there's three of each, or I'll mention three of each. There's many more barriers than three, of course. But one, and these are well known, but limited capacity. There's limited government capacity. It was weak before the earthquake. It's even weaker now. The Ministry of Education was particularly hard hit. It lost some really good staff. And even the FAES, which is the social fund, which implements a lot of the school construction activities, which has excellent capacity and which the IDB has used very effectively in the last few years to construct schools, they're now swimming, maybe drowning in money. Mm-hmm. They will continue to execute well, but they have their constraints or their limits. And, of course, the NGOs that are there and the NGOs that are now there have swelled, and so there's competition for the few scarce local skilled resources that can implement some of this stuff. Second barrier is political uncertainty. I'm not going to get into it because I think I'm running out of time. But and suffice to say, elections are upcoming, and it's not clear. Maybe we can get into it in the question and answer. It's not clear which direction things are heading in. Third barrier, donor and resource coordination. Yes, the resources are unprecedented. So is the capacity on the government side to coordinate us. I think thus far the Ministry of Education has done a fairly good job, thanks to logistical support by the IDB, I might add. You would think that I work for the IDB, my gosh. but now we're going to start seeing all of the demands on the scarce time of policymakers with the influx of the money. And now we're going to really see the cracks in their capacity to kind of shepherd us, or, I mean, it's sort of like herding the cats. This kind of leads me to the first of the opportunities, which is unprecedented resources. And I really do think this is an opportunity. For example, the WFP has incredible sums of money. They could feed all of the potential school children in Haiti this year and next year. They could. I mean, they've got that much money. So combined with an approach of massive school construction as proposed by the IDB, community-based approaches to increasing education supply, which is something that we're working on with the Ministry of Education, we could transform the education sector permanently in Haiti. Second opportunity is political will. There is a consensus on what needs to happen. Whether it's speaking to the Minister of Education, whether it's speaking to Jackie Lemarque, this leader of the Presidential Commission, whether it's attending events at the Inter-American Dialogue or listening to Marcelo or talking to UNICEF and others in Haiti, I mean, there is incredible consensus on what are the key actions that need to happen. And although the ideas themselves may not be new, I think the degree to which they are ubiquitous is new. And that is a great opportunity for gaining traction. Third, and I'll end with this, is momentum. I think that there's been good momentum infused into the education sector. There's a new generation, like a new guard of education officers that are in place there. I mean, I think literally UNICEF, UNESCO, World Bank, IDB, the Spanish, the Canadians, all have new people on the ground in Haiti, which isn't to say we had to get rid of the old guard, because with all due respect to myself as part of the old guard, we did things relatively well, and we had our successes, but this paradigm has shifted, and we need to be coordinating in a way that goes way beyond what had happened in the past. And I think that there's the energy and the leadership amongst those individuals to do that. So I'm going to end with this last statement, which is that the first thing that needs to happen, for which donors need to take responsibility, is a highly coordinated, time-bound, results-focused institutional strengthening program. Highly coordinated, time-bound, results-focused institutional strengthening program. And one which divvies up responsibilities for transforming and modernizing the education sector. So what I mean is, by highly coordinated, I mean seamless. I mean donors moving way past sharing information and actually working together in a way that we have not yet seen. And the price otherwise will be duplication at best, and at worst, we will pull the ministry into different and contradictory directions. By time-bound, I mean, and I think it's pretty self-evident, but I mean demonstrating successes early because we need to keep morale high. And then by results-focused, I mean some examples. We need to have an administrative office in the Ministry of Education that can manage international resources well and transparently so that we can phase out the role of the World Bank in housing a trust fund. We need to have a bona fide accreditation system for those non-public schools to recognize them and to get them on a track to improve the quality of services that they offer. We need a bona fide inspectorate to ensure and enforce those minimum standards of quality. And actually, it's in this vein, and I'm going to end on this little positive note, that UNICEF has convened us in Port-au-Prince in the next few weeks to have a two-day retreat to delve deeper into how we can actually work together and move beyond these the superficial level of the conversation and really, in French you say, responsabiliser, you know, assign responsibility, I suppose, to the donors so that we become more accountable for also helping the ministry achieve these targets.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. That's a huge amount that you gave us, particularly on those barriers and opportunities that I think will definitely feed into the discussion. And it also segues quite well to Marcelo, who, you know, given this recommendation of yours for this highly coordinated, time-bound institutional strengthening program, given that the Inter-American Development Bank has worked very closely with the government to develop a national education plan, which has just been endorsed by the Haitian Interim Recovery, the Haitian Interim Recovery Commission, and I wonder, Marcelo, if you can talk about whether this planning process has drawn on some of the lessons from the relief and recovery. Looking towards development, and how will support of the new plan work, really? And, you know, as a small question for you, what does the future hold?
Thank you for inviting me. All the questions are very difficult in the context in which we are. But let me start from the very beginning and refer to before the plan and not during the discussion. I'm not an expert in Haiti. I've been working quite a bit in the last 6 months after the earthquake, 9 months actually. And what started the conversation essentially was that immediately after the earthquake, the education sector in Haiti, in the conversations with the government, ranked very poorly in terms of priorities. So the first message that we need to send here is that in part the conversation has evolved in the last 9 months, and today we have everybody looking at the education sector as an area of immense challenges, and I agree with Peter on that, but also immense opportunities. So that's the first important message that I need to send you. Everybody's looking at this. Accountability is built in simply because of the conversation, and this accountability will survive. Hopefully, I'm going to touch on that point, throughout the political transition period that is coming. So this is the first message. Second message that is important, the plan is not innovative, and the plan is, of course, ambitious. But there are several things that needs to be underlined. The first one is ownership by the government of Haiti. And this is a statement that you need to check, but I make it here for all of you to know. This plan was developed at the same time that the Ministry of Education is coping with all the emergency and the situations of the case. At the same time, the Ministry of Education was capable of appointing a task force comprised mostly by people from the Ministry of Education and from the Presidential Commission on Education and put together a plan. So for all the weakness that we recognize in the institutions in education in Haiti, this is a second important point that you need to keep in mind. The plan, of course, reflects on things that were already happening in Haiti and make systemic choices that were not there before. One example is the subsidy system to non-public providers. This is now in the plan adopted as a policy, as a systemic policy, and not immediately as a pilot or limited effort. There's other things that the plan is doing well in our perspective. I think that it's taking on things that were already there, that had the promise to work, and taking or promising that they could take up to scale and incrementally be changing them as we go, but not necessarily refounding things that were already working. I go to the same example again. The subsidy system, as Peter said, was there, was working, and has a lot of promise. Of course, there's incremental changes that I would like to make, technically speaking, but from the political point of view, I think that the plan is very wise on taking on that issues. It takes on operational, from the relief and from the recovery effort, it's taking on some lessons. Of course, it's very early to incorporate lessons because it's almost parallel, the process. But I have two things at least that I want to put as lessons that is taking on well. The first one is a clear differentiation between the short term and the medium to long term. The plan has a three-month period, a back-to-school effort, which is very important and very visible. And you're going to see it on the headlines of every newspaper from now until the end of the year. And it separates the three-month effort from an 18-month effort. And the 18-month effort, it's what Peter was referring to. It's going to be the challenge of both putting together an institutional coalition, and I'm going to get to that point in a second, that makes the plan possible, but also to start working for the five-year third period of the plan. That is to say, the plan has a five-year of time horizon, and the 18 months are critical for that. One problem of coordination, or one difficulty for the government at this point, is that all the cameras and all the newspapers will be focusing on the 3 months. The 18-month will be something that, you know, you do if you have time and if you have the inclination. We are trying to separate a little bit the discussion and try to cover both at the same time. I'm going to get to that point in a second. So the first thing is separating one from the other. The other one is the, as Peter said, the issue of institutional strengthening. Institutional strengthening cannot happen by grace of the minister or the ministry itself. It needs to happen with our effort. There's been five efforts in the last 10 years of institutional strengthening of the ministry, and I'm talking about the most important ones. I'm not talking about the minor ones. We are trying to draw lessons from what happened on those efforts. Peter said they were not highly successful, and maybe that's an understatement of the year, but you know, they were not highly successful. And one of the things that is very clear to us is that we need, as donors, to work with the Ministry of Education in clear outputs with a time period that is clearly defined. This is resounding what Peter said. Of course, the issue here is the same way as we developed the plan had clear deadlines, and the government moved working with those deadlines. We need to use the same type of approach to do the 18-month effort. That is very important. Let me tell you two things about the challenge, and I'm not going to repeat what Peter said. I'm going to go to a much more political discussion. The first challenge is for this plan to survive the transition in Haiti. The political transition is a difficult one, as you well know. We don't know what the outcome of the election is going to be. The confusion is going to come from both sides, from the sides of the outgoing government, and from the side of a new government that probably will not have the structure to take on a situation as the one that we have now. This is why it's so important, the work of the interim commission. And this is, I guess, a very important political message. The Prime Minister, the President, and President Clinton will be very important for us as actors, asking all the time about how this project or this program, this plan is implementing. So everyone should be asking about, A, how the interim commission is working, because that's an open question for everybody, and second, how it's working vis-a-vis the education plan. Let me do a little bit footnote here. Why so this is so important? The commission, the plan was the first and only plan so far that is sector-wide, that it was presented to the commission. So education is the only sector that has been completely presented to the commission, and the commission has the possibility of not only making political decisions, but also helping the coordination of the efforts. So remember, two things. maintaining the momentum and also coordinating better. There is a political function there. It's not only the goodwill of the donors and the capacity of the ministry. The last thing that I want to say, money. That's the part that I know, okay? The plan is very ambitious in terms of money, $4.3 billion, okay? That's an immense amount of money. The plan also has $100 million needed for the first 3 months, $500 million needed for the first 18 months, and the rest will come for 5 years. What we recognize now is that the plan is, has the capacity to be implemented in a modular way. The challenge in the very short term for everybody is to get to the $100 million for the back to school. At this point, we have $25 million that the IDB has pledged for that effort, and we know that the money is there for the rest to get to the $100 million. The problem is to clarify what kind of pledges we're going to do to that. We're working on that issue, I told you. And separately, it's the issue of the $495 million, almost $500 million, that is needed for the 18 months. And this is very important because all the infrastructure that the plan, institutional infrastructure that the plan is supporting, depends on this money. At this point, we have $100 million, and I'm talking about the IDB because I have certainty about what the IDB can do. But that doesn't mean that there's no other money out there. I want to be very clear about that. But it's very important that, at least in the short term, we do the back to school very well, and we do the 18-month plan very well, fully financed. To the extent, and this is a hypothesis, it's a working hypothesis, and there's a lot not to believe about this. To the extent that then in the next 18 months, results are shown, that is to say, we get to train 10,000 teachers, we get to give 1,750,000 subsidies, to the extent that we can finance that effort, I think that there is a lot of donors and international institutions that would be willing to keep funding this plan. In terms of sustainability, and with this I finish because I'm sure the question is going to come, the plan is, from the financial point of view, it's based on two conditions, okay? So I want to be very clear. The first one, Haiti goes from 2% of the GDP in terms of public expenditure on education to 4% of the GDP. That is to say, still 1 point below what Latin America spends. And remember, the per capita expenditure in Haiti is very low. So it's a reachable effort. It's not impossible. Okay? So that's a discussion that, to the extent that we want to swap type of approaches, we need to have with the government. The other, the plan still depends on $100 to $130 million of foreign aid coming every year to education. Okay? This is not a self-sustained plan. To the extent that Haiti can go to the 5.2% of GDP expenditure that Latin America has on average, it would be a self-sustaining plan. But that's the future. That's the real, real future. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you so much. What I'm going to do at this time is actually, I'm going to open it up to discussion, to questions and discussion. We have, I think, two people with microphones. Is that the case? In the back? Yes, we do. And so what I'm going to ask is that you raise your hand, and when I point to you, someone will come with the microphone to please identify yourself, give both your name and your affiliation. We'll take about three or four questions each time, and then the panelists can respond. And I'd also just like to say at the outset that I think we all very much appreciate that there are a lot of experts in this room. But we'd like to ask you if you're going to make a statement, to please be following that with a question. We don't want any just formal, statements or presentations. So please be thinking about a question for the discussion. Okay, great. So I'll start here, and these two women then in the back.
Thank you, Patricia Fagan, U.S. Institute for Peace, and thanks to all the presentations, which were excellent and really informative. I was so happy to hear the two magic words for me, capacity building and institutional strengthening, coming from just about all of the speakers. Let me turn to the point Marcelo made is a first, but Peter really elaborated more, which is the importance of teacher training as a key marker, key indicator of success of the plan. Is a teacher training going to take place in Haiti, and will Haitians be part of this long-term capacity-building effort, which is indeed something for the future? And will Haitian universities be engaged in training the teachers, and if so, how is that going to work? Thank you.
Great, thank you. And then,
Hi, I'm Natalie Augustin with Save the Children here in D.C. Children, parents, and communities need to actively participate in the assessment, planning, design, and implementation, monitoring, and evaluation of early childhood care and education programs. To what extent was the input of children, parents, and communities sought in the development of the IDP plan? And to what extent will it continue to be part of the implementation of that plan going forward? Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lisa Swayhoover with the National Education Association, and my question piggybacks on her question about teacher training for Peter, is that you mentioned reducing the length of the teacher preparation from 3 years to one. My question is, how does that get to the issue of quality? We had a session here, a panel on September 8th about International Literacy Day that saw that there were not great gains in education and it's a quality issue. And the second part of that is how much have you interacted or engaged with the local teacher unions?
Great. Well, why don't we start with those two? So, actually, what I'd recommend is maybe that first, whoever wants to take it, the question about community participation within the development of the IDB plan and moving forward, and then we move from there to the teacher training question.
I'm not going to go in answering directly the question. I'm going to make a very important clarification, and I hope that this makes it very clear what our institutional perspective is. The moment we talk about the IDB plan, okay, we are talking about a different kind of conversation. The IDB plan is what we discuss with our board of directors in the context of our potential support for the effort in Haiti. To the extent that this is the IDB plan or anybody's plan, this is not going to go anywhere. So it's an important clarification, but I think that to the extent that we live here thinking that this is the IDB plan, I guarantee that it's not going to succeed. Okay?
So the National Education Plan. What about that? If we start talking about,
I think that you know
we
can use the plan as the plan. And then we can think whether we believe or not this plan is going to work or not. And then you know who's going to implement this plan, because designing the plan is 20%, as we all know here in this room, 20% of the effort. The other 80% is the implementation.
But I think if I'm correct, the question was going to the National Education Plan that was just endorsed. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, can you speak to the community participation in the development and how that will continue or even be enhanced in the implementation of that?
Yeah, the Presidential Commission had, as Peter said, 2 years of consultations in Haiti. That was, of course, before the earthquake. The consultations were wide, included not only communities, but also labor unions and the private sector. Another thing is that included the diaspora as well, which is very active still in the discussion. There was no consultations after the earthquake. President Prevar has plans for the next 3 months of consultation with the political parties or the candidates that are there. And some of the key institutions of society. That's going to happen in the next 3 months, but it's going to be limited in terms of we are in the middle of political transition, so consultations are going to be difficult. I think that the plan will need, to the extent that it's being implemented, a parallel process of consultation.
Okay. And now perhaps we could transition to the question of on teacher training and capacity building and the much larger effort there. Do you want to start, Peter?
Yeah, so there's various parts to it, but the reform that's been ongoing, it's been probably the hardest part of what we've been trying to implement over the last 3 years in implementing the EFA strategy. In part because of the stakeholder analysis, if you will, and we did work closely, actually, with teachers' unions. The most vocal, and this was expected, people that against the reform were students that were in the program, you know, that had already done 2 years. Well, like, what about me? You know, like, now, but those things are managed, and we spent 2 years of getting the program up and running and designing it, and now starting to be implemented. Unfortunately, we lost a lot of student teachers in the earthquake. I think about 301 institution, and overall, I think about 800. And so we've reduced all of the targets in terms of how many we're hoping to graduate and all that sort of thing. But the teachers' unions, there are many teachers' unions in Haiti. There isn't sort of one teachers' union. And it's not a very strong and vocal entity. But we did, during preparation, we do have good relations with them on the whole. And actually the head of the project is a former head of a teacher union, which helps kind of keeping the wolves at bay. I don't know. I can't really think of a good expression. The involvement of the universities. So our experience to date has been that of the teacher training agencies that have been involved in the reform, the universities have been the worst performing teacher training agencies. And the vision is certainly to have universities involved in the future. And the way that we had seen it at conception was that universities would play a kind of quality control role over the teacher training agencies themselves, but wouldn't necessarily be doing teacher training. That's kind of evolved, and they have been doing some training themselves, but it's... I don't actually follow this very closely, so I've basically just said everything that I know about teacher training in Haiti. But it's suffice it to say, it's been a very problematic part of the reform, but it's now on track in a way that it hasn't been previously. So I don't know. Marcelo may have things to add on teacher training. Or
no, I think that all the ingredients that Patricia was discussing will be there. I said that this is something that is taking on past efforts, trying to make incremental changes. So I don't see a radical change of strategy in the short term. Probably will take on what was been done before and discuss whether it would be 1 year, 2 years, but for sure it's going to be building on what is left of the universities in Haiti. They're also rebuilding. And for sure it's going to be a massive effort at the beginning to ignite quality transformation in Haiti.
Actually, I just wanted to touch on the quality question. I forgot to tackle that one. The recruitment for the student teachers was the first part of the reform, and it's led to much higher quality entrance into the program, which is the main way that we're improving the quality of the teachers that come out on the other end. But in fact, you in this room probably know this far better than I, but there are many experiences in Africa, in Benin, in Mali, et cetera, that have gone to these accelerated teacher training programs with very good results. And this is, in large part, building on those experiences. Right. I see a few people shaking their heads saying, no, that's not true. But,
Well, we can open up to another round of questions and perhaps some comments on, if people wanted to make comments on those lessons learned. We'll start here and then go here. And back there.
Hi, I'm Diana McHugh, and I'm an undergraduate at George Mason University. And I want to teach in Haiti or train teachers in Haiti, and this is all, I'm not an expert in this area at all, so I was just wondering what advice do you guys have for me or what resources can you refer me to help prepare me for that?
Great. And we have two over here.
Hi, my name is Carolyn Rose Avila. I'm with Plan USA. Talk about plans. This is maybe an elementary question. Maybe everybody understands it. How are all you folks coordinated? Is that what's happening in this meeting that's coming up? Because I heard Marcelo talk about the national plan. How is the World Bank supporting that? How is UNICEF supporting that? How is the cluster groups involved? There seems to be a plethora of resources around to back up the national government and to back up the Ministry of Education. So half cup, half full, half empty kind of thing. Secondly, is it focused countrywide? Are we talking countrywide? Because I know there's good teacher training going on, or there was prior to the earthquake in other parts of the country, in Port Salud, for example. Is there the word is decentralization that comes up all the time, but is there some kind of strategy that pulls in the rest of the country where it wasn't completely battered by the earthquake that can actually play a part of moving this kind of strategy forward? Thank you.
Great. And one more at the gentleman back there.
My name is Mike Faust from AIR. My question is, from your perspective, what is the role of the IHRC in taking decisions in the near future as to the implementation process for the education sector? And what is your level of confidence that that is the group that will begin to effectively oversee that process?
Great. What I'm going to suggest is that we start with the question about, you know, all of these groups are coordinating different plans, but who's coordinating them, and how are they coordinating together? And in particular, I feel like we haven't heard that much from Lisa because so much has been focused on the future, but it would be interesting to also hear how has the work that the cluster started been folded into these other efforts, and how's that coordination working? And then we have the question of the interim Haitian Recovery Commission and how's that decision-making working. And then a question finally on advice for how to get involved in teaching and where to look for resources and opportunities.
Okay, so in terms of coordinating amongst ourselves, I kind of mentioned it that it was certainly a learning for us as the cluster that it was so important to be really well aligned with the group sectoral d'education, the sector coordination mechanism, which is really, you know, these guys and all of the big players looking at the strategic planning for the reconstruction, etc. It's happened. We're certainly part of that mechanism now. The present cluster coordinator who's there is very active with that group. The upcoming meeting is very much involving both the cluster and represented by the cluster coordinator and team and the wider group. And so it's definitely something that maybe we were a little late coming at because the immediate needs were so great and the cluster partners were so busy meeting those needs, but it's certainly something that we reflected on and addressed as soon as possible. So the cluster is definitely a part of that. But the cluster had responsibility for the initial response and recovery within the earthquake zone specifically. Obviously, learners and communities that were moved to other parts of the country displaced because of the earthquake were still part of our responsibility too. But the broader plan, the education sector plan, definitely looks at the whole country and not just the quake zone. So that was the other part of that question.
And then from, yeah.
Well, can I tackle the IHRC question?
Okay. Do you mind if we first just stay on who's coordinating? So both the, you know, for the national education plan that's, you know, moving forward now, who's coordinating all of the actors then? We could stay on that and then move to the commission.
Well, in theory, right, there's this table sectoriel, which is kind of chaired by the minister and has participation from the non-public actors and the donors, right? It's sort of like the sector. Well, it's supposed to meet quarterly or something. It's met maybe once in the last 2 years or so. So that's not, I mean, on paper, that's the one that's coordinating everybody. I don't know that it's possible to coordinate everybody, especially just given the plethora of NGOs that are operating in the country and that are doing their little thing, you know, that are building their little school over in Jekmed or whatnot. I think that what we've done in the past in terms of coordinating in the among the international donors, it's been, you know, we've had this kind of various donors are take leadership on various issues. So, for instance, Canada has leadership on statistics and the kind of planning part of the of what happens with the Ministry of Education. The French had leadership on teacher professional development. The IDB was very much leading on school construction. We were leading on kind of private-public partnerships, that sort of thing. Looking forward, I mean, I'm not going to repeat what I said, but looking forward, we need to take this now from a sharing of information and a kind of, I think the concept of dividing and conquering is good. We need to just take it up a notch or 10 and really have more accountability between the donor and that part of the system that they're going to strengthen. If it's public-private partnerships, then it's getting this Office National de Partenariat en Education up and running, which is part of the plan, and I won't go into it. If it's teacher training, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
And just as a follow-on, is it a problem that the ministry, the department, or whoever you said was supposed to be coordinating quarterly, isn't? Or is that part of the strengthening, capacity strengthening plan that ultimately they will be coordinating this?
I mean, I think that those meetings need to happen more frequently, but what we can really achieve with them, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that the best thing we can do is have this plan that outlines a vision that we've all endorsed. And then this kind of segues into the IHRC question. You know, people are various organizations that are preparing interventions in the sector, you know, need to be within that plan. And if they're not within that plan, then they need to be they need to be approved by the IHRC. Because okay. The IHRC, this is, Marcelo will correct me. This is, I'm moving into the IHRC
yeah.
question now. Is that
I
okay?
Think that's good.
And this is off the record, right? So the IHRC endorsed this plan, and now activities that are under that plan, as I see it, have the blessing to move forward. Activities that are not under that plan do not have the blessing to go forward and would have to go to the IHRC. And then I don't really see a role for the IHRC in the actual implementation. I mean, I don't think that we're going to get IHRC officers that are going to come and supervise the activities or anything like that. I mean, with all due respect to the IHRC, it has enough trouble meeting and reading the proposals that they're receiving and passing them on to the Haiti Reconstruction Fund for financing. So I think the role is really limited to gatekeeper, yes, this is a national priority, go ahead, rather than go ahead and how are you guys doing and please report back into us every 3 months and et cetera, et cetera. Marcelo, do you think that's a good...
Yeah, the first thing on coordination, it's a, I'm going to say a truism here, it's a difficult thing. It's a complicated issue, and coordination doesn't happen in meetings. You can have as many meetings as you want. So I think that what Peter is saying is the 18-month plan that the plan includes, basically, it's based on an approach that will include actual work from the donors and from the minister. And I'm saying the donors and the minister under the same roof, moving under deadlines and with clear results. And that can be accomplished. That can be accomplished. It's not going to be accomplished in the discussions in meetings, whether they're weekly meetings, bi-weekly meetings, or whatever. It's not going to happen there. It's going to happen the same way that the plan was developed, a task force in which the minister or the ministry is leading with the donors, probably with a division of labor, as Peter is saying, and with clear products that needs to be defined. They're not going to be perfect, because that's the other issue. I mean, perfection, perfect components will not come out from this effort. Doable things needs to come out from this effort. So this is an important thing. With the interim commission, this is a difficult question, too. Let's put it this way. The interim commission has international visibility. President Clinton has, of course, a lot in that agenda, and they will not have the capacity to add any technical value in the short term to the discussion. I don't think that that's going to be the outcome of the interim commission. What they will do, or what they could do, is to have the issue of implementation of the plan as a political issue. And this is not, again, a technical issue. It's not checking on anybody's work. It's saying, look, you know, we are the agent that for the next 6 months to a year will be asking in each meeting that we have, how is this going or how is this not going? Okay, this is for us, this is what we, when we talk with President Clinton, that's also always the discussion. The discussion is not that they're going to be a parallel Ministry of Education or a parallel government, because they cannot be. But in this narrow issue of education, I think that we have a clear discussion of what they could do for us.
Okay, thank you. Before we move on, actually, just to get to the question of teachers, how to, you know, where to look for teacher resources and opportunities to teach in Haiti, if either of you three have any responses.
There was a lot of noise in discussion at the beginning of this conversation about programs like Teach for America and these kind of efforts. Still, the conversations are going. They are very slow by my standards. So I don't know if they're going to happen or not.
I could say online, there are certainly a lot of resources that you could find, whether Teachers Without Borders, even the Interagency Network for Education Emergencies, many groups would have some links there that could be interesting for resources,
I mean, I would think your best bet are like the NGOs like Plan and like Save, if I could just put the onus on the people that are in the audience, those might be your best.
There's a One Response website that has lists all of the various partners who are working on different aspects of the response. Can give that to you later.
Great. We have a question back here.
Very quick. I am Annie Quainer, Science Counselor at the French Embassy. And I have, again, a question of coordination, which was already. I think Peter already answered more or less about coordination between countries. You said that it's good. I mean, so is it easy? Is it going well? Okay. And the second question is more technical about the language for children and for also training of teachers. Okay. How can you manage? Because it can be. Thank you.
Thank you. And I saw another hand, two hands over here.
Hi, my name is Aya. I just graduated from Fletcher School at Tufts University. I heard a lot about donor coordination from you, but I wonder what about government engagement and involvement? You talked about ownership is crucial, but is there any concrete results that is out there? For example, any more school inspectors and teachers out there in place? Or are there any strengthened trust between teachers and parents and, or school inspectors and teachers? And is there any like job descriptions in place in among the Ministry of Education officials and sign of following those responsibilities, those concrete signs I would like to know in after the earthquake. And also my second question is, given the very little capacity even before the earthquake and immense amount of money, I cannot help think about the corruption issue. Is the money really reaching the children or teachers, or is it stopped at the government high-level officials? Those are my questions. Thank you.
Hi, Susan Nicolai with the Global Education Cluster Unit in Geneva. I was actually interested to hear a little bit more about the approach to private sector providers, given that the vast majority of schooling in Haiti, and you had mentioned something about a subsidy plan to non-public providers, and just to hear a little bit more about how that issue is being tackled.
Great. So we have a plethora of issues for this response. We've got a question of the private sector providers, a question on corruption, a question on how we've heard a lot about the coordination and the donor coordination. How's it actually working? A question about the language issue, which is a really difficult one, of course, historically and presently, and a question of sort of given government engagement, what are some of the concrete results in strengthening capacity for inspection and engagement, especially at local level, it sounds like you're talking about. So I don't know, Peter, do you feel like starting
I'll with start with the ones that I can answer, and then we'll address the others later. The subsidy program, and I'm going to tie it into the corruption. So the idea is that we believe in public services, that they be free. And we believe in public financing of those public services. And then if the provision is private or public in Haiti right now, it's a secondary issue and we're not too concerned about it. The way that the program works is that we finance, when the school enters into the program in grade one, all the students in grade one that are entering grade one for the first time, that are between the ages of 6 and 8, which was UNICEF's insistence, a very good one, to make sure that we're getting the kids starting on time, are eligible for the tuition waiver. Our social analyses were telling us that it was better to say, to target the school, rather than to try to target the kids within the school and say, you yes, you no, because you end up just sort of fomenting more divisions at the community level. So the school's in, all the children in that grade are in. And then there's third-party technical audits that visit each and every one of the schools. So it's not like a sample audit. It's every school then gets visited by a firm, so not a school inspector. They also get visited by the school inspectors that go to collect the financial reports. But this third party goes and counts. You said you had 42 students in grade one, and you count 30, we only count 37, or check with the communities. They also check with the parents to make sure that they haven't paid tuition, because that tuition has been paid through the program. And then the students that are subsidized need to have manuals. So really there are two conditions to get into the program. One, you need to have some kind of accreditation. That is, they can't be functioning in total illegality because it's just difficult from a legal perspective. And second, they need to be providing textbooks. And then they can't be charging fees, obviously, to the parents. The funds flow from Washington or Ottawa or Barbados, the Caribbean Development Bank, to an account in the central bank in Haiti. And then from there, they're transferred directly onto the bank accounts of the schools that are opened by the school management committees and the directors, school directors jointly. And the school management committee and the director, so the representative of the parents, basically, and the director, co-sign on that money. This is a way to minimize the corruption that happens in Port-au-Prince and that happens at the higher levels of government. And there's sort of a conscious decision to say, let's take the risks more at the community level. I mean, we have the third-party verification. We have the schools and the parents involved. I mean, there's no such thing as a perfect system, but we decided to err on the risk of having leakage, as we refer to it, in these, you know, more remote rural areas than to have leakage happen in public place. I'll stop there, but those, I tried to address those two questions. Oh, while I'm at it, with the parents involved in the schools, we're actually trying to foment more distrust between parents and teachers because what we want to see is that teachers are being accountable to parents. Right now, I think I would say we have a situation of trust or a situation of fear, that the parents would never confront the teacher or check on the teacher or report if the teacher was absent or intoxicated or whatnot. So what we're trying to do is empower parents to have to have teachers be a little bit more accountable, all the while making sure that there's something in it for the teacher, right? Because these guys are working super hard, and I mean, I use the term guys, and most of them are women. and they're often not paid. So you have to have the tuition waiver program with the money arriving, you know, early and teachers being paid, and then in exchange, they're being monitored by the parents and that sort of thing.
Okay, do either of you want to follow on those issues, which were both on sort of some corruption issues and also strengthening, you know, in the end, it was a lot about the parent-teacher community involvement and capacity.
Just to say that both subsidies and accreditation, they go together. They are not perfect at this point in terms of the way it works. They have two problems. They have the problem of, you know, whether they're technically well calibrated for the incentives that we want to put in the systems. That is to say, more control by the parents or less control by the schools. We need to work on that, and that's part of the 18-month discussion. And the other issue, of course, is the calibration of the money, how much of the subsidy. The accreditation part, it's also a very difficult one. We have very few schools fully accredited by the Ministry of Education. It's a cumbersome process, and there's no capacity to do that. So the plan is talking about a very simple type of accreditation that probably will survive for the next 5 years. And that's going to be to count how many teachers they have, what kind of training they have, and whether they are in school or not.
Lisa, did you have anything?
No,
that?
I was going to talk about the government engagement question.
Okay.
Just from the perspective of the cluster in any case, but we were very conscious of ensuring that the Ministry of Education was leading the response efforts with our support rather than the other way around. And we had to reorganize ourselves, how we were coordinated to make sure that that happened meaningfully and not just in terms of chairing a meeting. And really that was probably most successful at the local levels because we directly involved the inspectors. As I mentioned, the inspector knows the commune very well, knows the schools very well. It wasn't easy. They have obviously limited capacity. In many cases, we lost a lot of the Ministry of Education staff, as we've heard. But it was definitely a focus of our outreach and capacity development, making sure that when doing needs assessments, that those were done under the leadership of the inspector, you know, providing training so that they would be able to develop and conduct those assessments, training on planning and contingency planning, particularly coming up to cyclone season, as I mentioned too. It's a hierarchical structure, of course, and if they didn't have the okay of their supervisors, it became very difficult. So that was something we had to counter. At national level, we made sure that the national cluster, particularly the strategic group element, and then we had an open forum of the broader membership, that those were co-led by the cluster and the ministry, and having a dedicated focal point and meeting regularly and planning jointly with the ministry ensured that that happened. So it was something we had to work very hard at, but the results were very evident then on the ground.
Do any of you feel comfortable tackling the issue of language? Given Creole, French, English, And
I mean, people in this room know this far better than I do, but it's pretty difficult to teach a child to read in a foreign language, which is, for 95% of Haitian households, the reality when kids go into school and try to learn French. In fact, if we can teach them to read in Creole in grades 1 and 2, then they will learn French much more easily when they get into grades 3 and 4. I'm already kind of out on a limb here in terms of my knowledge, so I'm going to leave it at that.
The plan embraces that kind of approach. What I understand, I'm not an expert on this issue, but what I understand is that embraces a bilingual approach. And I think that in spite of the recommendation of the commission that it was to do Creole and then French, I think that the plan went against that recommendation, if I understand correctly. This is one of the key examples of how Haitians working by themselves with our capacity added, they can solve or make decisions about important issues about the future of education there. This was a difficult discussion, and they needed to, you know, get together and get to a decision, and they did it.
Okay. We have 5 minutes left, and we haven't tackled the very big issue that Susan brought up as well around private sector providers, and how is also the plan, National Education Plan, tackling that issue, given that 80% to 90% of education was provided by private sector, and how to bring quality and accountability more in line.
So the vision with the tuition waiver program that I described is obviously for private providers, right? And the idea there, and I mentioned the very basic conditions right now to participate. The strategy in the medium term and the longer term is one of shifting the goalposts. So as the facts on the ground change, and as we have more trained teachers on the market, then we can say, well, in order to qualify for this program, not only do you have to give the textbooks and waive the tuition, you also have to have a trained teacher teaching in grade 1 or teaching in each grade that's subsidized. Or, you know, as Marcelo mentioned, it's all a question of calibration, because you need to continuously provide the incentives and the support in order for them to be improving their quality. And, you know, some schools will drop off in the bottom end that can't, you know, meet those standards. And you'll hopefully just little by little increase the standards and the quality of education in these schools. But I mean, it's donors have to be in there for the long term.
The effort probably will start with the schools that are, it's very heterogeneous, the supply of schools in the non-public sector, of course, we understand that. So the discussion will probably start with the bottom of the distribution, not with the top of the distribution, because the $100, $120 subsidy that this program will bring will not entice necessarily the participation at the beginning, unless there's some sort of calibration in terms of how much the parents still contribute to education and how much the subsidy covers. But this is going to be a gradual discussion. There's not going to be one subsidy. In the future, there will be more than one subsidy, but that's a question of institutional capacity again. The moment we start to slice it very thinly, the institutional capacity is not there to differentiate between one type of provision and the other. That could be in the future.
Okay. Before we move to closing, I'd like to offer all of the panelists, you know, an opportunity to say a few concluding remarks. Again, keeping in mind the theme of from relief to development, what are the next steps? If there are some issues that you feel haven't been brought up that you'd like to highlight for us, you know, or if it's some of the issues that you have brought up that you'd really like us to keep in our minds as we you know, leave this room, just to offer you each a minute or so to offer that. We could go in the same speaking order, actually. So, Lisa.
Okay. Well, it strikes me really sitting here listening to everyone that we really are covering the full spectrum, not only of the response to the recovery and the longer-term reconstruction, but also the school classroom level engagement right up to the institutions and the broader political sphere. But I have to wave the flag, and my responsibility as a cluster coordinator was to represent a very large group of partners who were doing and are continuing to do tremendous work on the ground. And, you know, that little NGO working on that little school in Jacmel, when you combine the efforts of the enormous number of partners who are doing that, it's quite amazing the impact they're having. And one thing that struck me very much while working in Haiti was how much Haitians prioritize education. Mm-hmm. Up to 70% of household incomes in some cases going on school fees. So all of us together have a real responsibility and a real opportunity to make the transformative changes we've discussed.
Peter.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have much else to add. I was just going to also echo this idea of opportunity, that in the wake of the earthquake, you did hear people say, oh, it's devastating, but really this could be a real opportunity. And then lately I've been hearing, it wasn't an opportunity, it was just devastation. And we heard that at the dialogue a couple of weeks ago when RAND presented their report, and I'm sure they mentioned a similar message at the Institute of Peace when they presented there. Actually, it is still like this incredible window to change things permanently in Haiti. And when we lose sight of that historic moment that we are in, then it's a bit sad. Like, I think we need to keep up the energy and the enthusiasm, and that's how we're going to kind of seize this moment. Because it comes down to individuals, and it comes down to just that momentum. I think that momentum is there. I've seen it, and I hope we can keep it up. I mean, I know that we can keep it up. I hope that we do keep it up.
Thank you. And Marcelo?
Not an institutional story, a personal story, very quickly. I lived in Haiti after the earthquake for a month and a half, and I've been going back and forth quite a bit. I work with another 25 countries, but Haiti has been my focus in the last 9 months. Will continue to be. Most of the time, and for all of you that have experience in Haiti, the feeling was that I was doing one step ahead and two to the back, behind. I don't know how to say it. So essentially, I was doing no progress. Every day, I came back to my trailer or whatever it was, a container, essentially. And I had to recover to continue working on the project. We are very proud as an institution to be able to support the Haitian government in the next 10 years for education change in Haiti. But for me personally, it was the most rewarding, or it has been the most rewarding effort that I've done in 14 years working in development in Latin America.
Well, thank you. I want to thank everyone in the audience for your time and your questions and your thoughtfulness. And I particularly want to thank Peter and Lisa and Marcelo. And I hope everyone here is leaving with what I'm leaving with, which is a feeling of the overarching opportunity despite the barriers, but the opportunities to continue this momentum and continue with sustained engagement that all of us in this room hopefully are bringing and taking forward. So thank you. Thank you.